Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
Today I'm joined by Mrs. Sarah Mayling, a consultant ophthalmologist from Oxford, and the college lead for specialty recruitment. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about specialty recruitment, especially in light of the huge changes that have been made this year as a result of the pandemic. A lot of candidates will be quite worried and anxious about the deviations and the changes to the process that some candidates might be quite used to already. And just to start with, I was just wondering, what would you say to a candidate who's quite anxious about whether they feel that the changes have been made in a fair or robust way, or to ensure that the right person is being selected for the job?
So Sunil, first of all, it's lovely to be here, and also thank you so much for the opportunity to be able to perhaps address some of the questions and queries that an appropriately anxious group of want-to-be ophthalmologists are posing. I think we can all honestly reflect on the last 12 to 18 months and say it has been somewhat challenging, and certainly asked of us different skill sets than we've ever had to deal with in the past. And as the head of recruitment, I can say that I was not expecting to have to be involved in so many changes for recruitment really across all subspecialties. So if you wouldn't mind, I'm just going to give you a couple of information points about recruitment for subspecialties across the country. When the first COVID lockdown happened, which was, as we know, at the beginning of 2020, all of the recruitment subspecialty chairs got together across all divisions of medicine and surgery to think about how we might move forward with recruitment. And as ophthalmology, we were really ahead of the pack at that point in time because we had had and completed our recruitment round. And this really meant that we were able to sort of influence the way that what was asked to be planned, which was plan A, B and C for all subspecialties, was going to happen in the coming months. And really what I suppose I want all applicants to ophthalmology to know is that at all points and times of these conversations and Zoom meetings, we have put the fairness and the robustness of the system at the front of our planning as opposed to logistics. But we have been quite limited by what we are able to do by national requirements. And that means that face-to-face interviewing is something that is not going to be able to be done across any specialty. And those who've been following the news recently will know that that has become even more difficult as consultant physicians have been unable to be released from their workplaces to interview core medical applicants. So what we have tried to do is achieve a system that we have evidence-based as being fair by reviewing all of the evidence that we've collected over the last 10 years, but also have some face validity, which we as a college and we hope as a group of applicants have been interviewed across specialties have wanted to have some face-to-face element to the recruitment.
Yeah, that sounds really reassuring that so much thought and work has gone into the recruitment process. Historically, I remember this as well when I was applying some years ago, candidates went through a critical appraisal, quality improvement station, a clinical station, and then a communication station. How did you decide that you only wanted to have a communication station this year?
Yeah, so we've been able to sub-analyze, for those of you who've heard my podcast that we did before, we've been able to sub-analyze every part of the recruitment process across every applicant for all the recruitment processes that have followed that pattern. And one of the things that we have looked at also is what each of those stations equate to in terms of recruitment. Because if we take it one step away from why pick communication, why bother with any testing in recruitment? Why not just put names in a hat? And what we know from evidence about our recruitment process, that testing clinical knowledge, testing ability to appraise a paper, and testing some of the other areas that we've looked at in the past, they are able to be incorporated within an appropriate portfolio. But actually watching a candidate have a conversation with a patient is not something that you can easily pick out in real world measurable ways from a portfolio, particularly if not every candidate is using a work-based assessment style. And I'm sure some applicants will agree that the CRS1 history, which is used in ophthalmology for those coming into ST1, they'll get to know this this WB, work-based assessment, that is often not particularly well done within trusts about how it's looked at. And actually how a doctor interacts with a patient is very important to us on the recruitment board to show that doctors who are applying to a specialty are able to do that.
Mm. So that's really interesting that you're not really going to be testing any clinical knowledge at all then this year in contrast to the other years.
Well, if you forgive me for slightly interrupting, I would argue that that is possibly not true, because if you think about any consultation you might have with a patient, I would say that a certain percentage of any interaction, which I would consider a professional and clinical interaction, would include quite a lot of clinical knowledge. So what we are trying to bring is in some ways the pinnacle of the triangle. So what we are looking at is what a doctor actually does. It might interest you to know that some of the conversations that I had across different disciplines of medicine were explaining how online consultations have become a norm of this pandemic. And actually, as ophthalmology, we will be one of the only subspecialty schools that are actually going to assess this in our recruitment process.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I just had a flashback to my very own OSCE in medical school, when I was asked to explain to a patient temporomandibular joint dysfunction, and I thought it was just a case of having the skills to explain something. But I really fell down by having zero knowledge about that condition. So I think, yeah, as you say, knowledge and clinical and communication skills do all really come together in this type of scenario, potentially.
And I do think that the cohort of applicants this year will be anxious because it's different. And so they won't have been able to prepare for it and they won't quite know what's coming. Obviously, the portfolio is the same as it's always been, or with minor alterations. But I think they need to just be true to themselves. And if they are doctors, which they all are, who've been doing clinical work, which they all have been, and are able to talk to a patient, that is what is going to be asked of them.
Yeah, as we all know from attending various online webinars and seminars and sessions and having endless Zoom meetings, we're no stranger to technical issues, either with dodgy webcams, poor quality microphones, internet connectivity issues. Have you thought about that, and have you kind of considered how you might penalise a candidate if they do have such technical issues during their interview?
Okay, so we will certainly not be penalising anybody who has technical issues. Have we thought about it? Yes, in infinitesimal detail. Will we be perfect? No, absolutely not. But we will be as prepared as we can think of being prepared. So that means for every single technical difficulty that we can think of, we have a plan in place. So if you aren't able to access the interview at all, obviously another time will be given. If you are in the middle of the interview and there is a technical problem, depending at which point through the interview you are, you will either pause and restart or you will be given another slot. If you have any issue, and all of the interviews have somebody overseeing them, that is different to the people who are within the interview itself, so the interviewers. So each interview is micromanaged. So hopefully we are able to allow everything to run on the day that is planned, but we already have extra days in the diary with technical support available should we need them down the line.
Okay, well, that's really reassuring. So one of the questions that we had posted to us on Facebook was, what happens if we ourselves fall ill due to COVID around the interview time? I work in A&E in a direct contact with COVID patients and aerosol generating procedures on a daily basis, and I'm worried about this possibility.
Absolutely. So because we have a backup day, anybody who is unwell in the day and unable to conduct a 5-minute interview within the confines of their home and feels that that's something they're not able to do, we would have to obviously send to us all the information. All the normal rules for illness during an exam would apply. So they would need to have a doctor's note. They would need to have agreement from their trust that they have been, you know, that their managers know that they were off sick. All the things that any other candidate listening to this who is turning up for their interview would expect us to do for anyone who says they're not feeling very well. We're not trying to in any way limit people and say, don't, you know, you must come, but we need to make sure that due process is followed. So as long as all due process is followed, which are the normal rules for not attending an exam, if in a situation, particularly with COVID, where somebody was not well enough, then we would almost certainly offer them the other dates that we have available.
Yeah. So in contrast to previous years, you know, the recruitment team's really going the extra mile this year to give people every opportunity possible if they can't attend on the day.
Absolutely. I mean, we plan that there will be technical hitches. We think that we will be able to accommodate everybody and every situation. What I hope all of the applicants will understand we cannot do is change the rules. So if people we always set rules in the past that if you can't attend, you'll have to wait for the further, you know, the other rounds of application. And so every single appeal really will be looked at in an individual context to work out what needs to be done. But certainly somebody with COVID wouldn't need to worry about it.
So forgive my ignorance with this question, but regarding the MSRA, has that already happened? And you know, if it hasn't, are there any concerns or plans or contingencies if candidates are unable to attend for that?
Yeah, so the MSRA component of the application, for as far as I know right now at this moment, is running as planned. Because, for instance, in psychiatry and GP recruitment processes, that is 100% of their recruitment process. So the BMA and the recruitment teams across the country have been organising for all those applicants who require MSRA access to it. There are both slots available in the Pearson centres as well as online slots. So as far as I know, because I've not had any indication otherwise, it is all running and all the candidates are aware of the plans for the MSRA. So that will still be a component.
Sure. So one of the other questions that we've had is, a lot about the interview has changed in 2021 due to the pandemic. Do you envisage similar changes to be taken into 2022? Or do you believe that in light of what's changed this year, making it online, you know, perhaps bringing more equitable access to interviews rather than having candidates travel so far, do you imagine that this process might be adopted into the future beyond the pandemic as well?
Yes, it was really interesting. Shona McLeod, when she chaired the first meeting about this, said, you know, we mustn't look at it all as negative. We may find some positives out of it. Unfortunately, I'm a bit of a data nerd when it comes to things like this. And my belief is that we should be producing a reproducible, fair and robust system that affords every candidate equal opportunity into training. And I think the best way for us to do that is to look at what our data produces this year. Because we are extremely fortunate that we have data now for 10 years, that we can look at we can break down how performances across different aspects of recruitment and see whether we are having the same, different, and in what way, if it's different, the results will be. And I would only be persuaded to move to a system such as this if it was shown to either be exactly the same or better than the system we had previously. I'm not interested in cutting any corners.
That sounds very, very reasonable. The next question is, the publication score in the portfolio this year has changed from 10 points to 5 points. Would it be possible for you to shed some light on the process behind that? And how does the recruitment committee collectively decide how many points are different sections worth, and why does this change on a year-by-year basis?
So it's always interesting when you look at two sides of a coin. The numbers that are allocated to each section actually don't always affect the overall score. So this year, our point allocation for everything has changed because we are missing several sections that we didn't have before. So it doesn't mean that the percentage overall will change because each specific point is different. It is that we have to come up with a number that the entire recruitment process is out of, and this year all of it's changed. So although the publication part may be the only one that's obvious on the portfolio, actually there's lots of other point changes for the MSRA and the online component to allow us to have a robust score overall. So it's not something that is going to our understanding, it's not something that will affect anybody who is a particularly highly published applicant be in any way not receiving what they should receive compared to somebody before. You know, it'll even out once all the scores are in.
Yeah. So this year, are you quite excited or looking forward to the prospect of being able to review portfolios through the internet rather than potentially wading through massive binders?
No, it's a nightmare. For us, this is not is far harder than what we do normally. And actually, they're not massive bindings anymore. So, you know, we're really specific about what we ask to be put into the portfolio. And actually, people who turn up with huge binders that are filled with pieces of paper are often marked down, because unless it fits absolutely specifically to what we ask for, it just, you know, they get marked down for adding stuff in that isn't adding to their score. So what is really easy for our interviewers is to take, everything's marked by two people. And so it is very easy to have them all in a room, and it's safe and it's robust and it's reproducible because everybody's there and any questions are asked by the same people at the same time. So we've had to recreate that online. So for me, this is a huge, there's the interviewers have 2.5 weeks in which to mark the portfolios, and I have to be accessible for long periods of time for people to be able to ask me questions. Plus, we have to do online training for everybody to make sure people do it on time. We have to make sure everybody does it fairly. We have to do two-pronged marking the way that we did, the way you imagine with diabetic screening. So we have portfolios marked by two independent assessors, and then 10% are marked to make sure there's no abnormalities. And then we have to get together and make sure that there's no changes in the way that people have been marked in different locations to make sure it is as fair as we can possibly make it. So actually, this is just a very, very big amount of work.
Yeah, no, that does sound like a huge amount of work. Have you?
And if they take, sorry to interrupt, if they take the MSRA out of that, you will multiply the number of portfolios needing to be marked by more than three.
Yeah.
So three times the number, which is a behemoth task. But compared to some specialties, it's still manageable.
Okay. So have you worried at all this year that you may have less examiners for the interview itself than you have in previous years because of clinical commitments?
Well, actually, I filled all my slots and I have an entire surplus of double everybody up. Wow. So oddly, interviewers, because they don't have to travel and because they are able to do it a little bit more in their own time, and because I think ophthalmologists across the country really feel that they want to help, we have got a surplus of interviewers. So we are absolutely at quotient and plus. So we're very, very lucky.
No, that's actually excellent, isn't it?
It also means that we can, I think candidates, I know when I was sitting exams, you always felt that if things went badly, that the person that was interviewing you clearly was new to the job and didn't quite understand the process. I think since I've come in to the role that I've taken on, I really want to emphasise how fair we try and make this process. I'm running, I think, three online teaching pre-interview workshops for all the interviewers to attend. So everyone will be trained. They get it recorded so they can reflect back on it. And I think that, and the fact that we have so many people volunteering to be part of the system this year, it means we've got a lot of people who've done it many times before. And that helps with reproducibility.
Of course. So one of the next questions we have is, I wanted to ask if it was known whether there is a time limit on the virtual patient consultation, and if so, how long will it be? I appreciate the whole interview will last 30 minutes in total, but how long will the actual consultation last for?
Yeah, so there will absolutely be a time limit. The reason for the long ish interview time that you're given is that that affords us quite a lot of what we would call fat in the equation. So you will attend your meeting, you will be identification checked. We will then make sure that everything is working. You'll then start your consultation for the designated time, which I'm not going to tell you what it is because in case people don't hear this podcast, I just don't want everybody, some to know and some not to know, but there will be a designated time and then it will finish. You will then be given a chance to be able to make sure that everything was as it should be, and then it will be done.
Okay, that's very reasonable.
So the consultation will be longer than 30 minutes, but more than 4 minutes.
Okay. And are there going to be two consultants watching this interview process then?
Yes. So the plan at the moment is that you'll be asked to join a Teams room, and within the room there will be two consultants who you cannot see. So you will see your patient and you will know that there are two consultants watching you.
Okay. And what about virtual backgrounds? Are candidates encouraged to use virtual backgrounds or discouraged, or it doesn't matter at all?
Yes. So all of that information will come out when they are sent their interview, when they're asked, you know, to book their slots, and their interview information comes out. Certainly our patients will be having generic type backgrounds. And I think my piece of advice, and this is more a Sarah piece of advice than anything else, is this is an interview where you're having a consultation with a patient. So I would ask that candidates would have a background that they feel is appropriate for an interview with a patient.
Hmm. Yeah. So perhaps if the candidate was otherwise doing the interview in their bedroom, they could change the virtual background to having an iClinic room in the background.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's great. So would you have any, I mean, that's a really good piece of advice, but would you ever have any other, you know, pieces of advice or suggestions for candidates, you know, especially those who might feel anxious about the prospect of having to go through a virtual consultation or virtual set type of interview compared to a face-to-face interview?
Yes, I think if you'd asked me that 3 years ago, I'd have said you need to start doing some virtual conversations and asking for feedback. I think now in 2021, with the year we've just had, I think the bright and motivated people that are applying to ophthalmology will have conducted so many online interactions in the last 12 months that I think the least of their worries should be the online interaction. if there is somebody who's been somehow living under a rock and has never done an online interaction with a human being before, they need to do one before they come to their interview. But I cannot imagine at this just juncture of life that that will be something that people will be concerned about.
Do candidates need to use their laptop or can they use another device? You know, do you recommend people buy expensive laptops or microphones to give themselves the best possible impression of themselves?
I think we certainly don't want people spending money in order to do this interview. My own experience is that mobile phones are now in many cases more than sufficient for conducting an online consultation. The picture quality is often better than some laptops, and actually the audio we find is very good. As interviewers, what we are interested in is seeing our candidates' faces. We want to be able to hear their voices and we want to be able to see them interacting with the patient. And I think in many cases, you would find that a mobile phone would be sufficient for that. Of course, laptops and desktops and any other form of infrastructure that our candidates are comfortable with is great. But if their best way of and most familiar way of communicating with people is a phone, we're very happy for them to use that.
Well, that's really, really useful. And I suppose a good way of telling how good one's quality is, you know, if people can just, you know, do a Zoom call with their friend and then maybe record it and watch it back afterwards, that's a good way to judge how your quality is.
Absolutely. I've always said the best way to get ready for an interview is to try and have a practice. And we know that this interview is going to be conducted online. We know you're going to be talking to a human being. So just as you say, do a Zoom call, do a WhatsApp call, do whatever call you want with somebody and just check what you're most comfortable with.
Great. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today. I think that's answered so many questions that I was personally curious about, and I'm sure many of the applicants have been worrying about as well.
I'm going to just say one more thing before we go, and that is I really want to give a heartfelt message to all the people that are applying this year, that we are all ophthalmologists who have been doing and the same things that they have during the pandemic in some ways, and we understand fully that they are having a difficult time. We are trying our very best to deliver as fair a system as possible to allow all those people that want into ophthalmology a system that they can at least trust will give us a way for us to pick people for a specialty that we know so many people want to do. We know it's not perfect. We know it's new. Nobody ever likes to be the first person. But the team of us that have tried to organise this have put our applicants first, not last. And so we really hope that they feel that they're being given a fair and open approach to recruitment this year.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, that's been really helpful. And hopefully we can talk again this time next year for an interview about recruitment 2022.
Absolutely. And all those statistics, it'll be like more or less.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.